We connect people with the things they love, but we specifically do so through the lens of the individual. What we do, I think, uniquely well is show you what it's like to be in someone else's shoes or give you a peek behind the curtain.
Welcome to Teach Me Something New. I'm your host, Britt Morin, and this is a production of iHeartRadio and Brit & Co. All my life, everyone's told me I should focus on being good at one thing. But the truth is, I'm curious about a lot of things. But how do you learn about everything? The answer? Make the world's best experts teach you in less than an hour. So come along with me as we all learn something new. In today's episode, we're sitting down with the head of Instagram, Adam Mosseri. My husband, Dave, who not only worked at Facebook in the early days, but also launched and sold his own social network called Path, joins me as we all discuss what's going on in our modern social media world. Hey guys, it's Britt, and I'm back with the one and only Mr. Dave Morin.
My husband, my partner in crime, on just about everything.
Hey, Britt.
Work and life related. And we are really pumped about our guest today. We are so happy to call this man a colleague and a friend. We've had all kinds of life adventures together for over a decade now. And for
has
all
really
of you,
been that long?
I think it has.
I think it has, wow. Yeah.
Dave, you're killing my lead here. Okay, all of you out there, we're just going to get to it. You might have heard of him. He runs a little social media platform called Instagram. He is Adam Mosseri. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
You're here. Thank you. Okay.
It's good to have you, man.
So let's just get to it. Adam Mosseri is here to teach us something new about leading one of the largest social media platforms in the world. All right. So I'm not sure how many people know this, Adam, but is it true you started as a designer at Facebook?
I did. I started as a product designer. Back in 2008, July 08.
So you've been there for almost 12 years.
We actually worked together.
We did. We overlapped. When you say it out loud, 12 years, though, it sounds like too many.
Mm-hmm. It really does.
Okay. So what were the last 12 years like then in terms of moving from designer to head of Instagram? Was this ever something you were expecting?
I love design. I learned a lot from my time as a designer. I don't think I was ever that great a designer. I was sort of a middle of the pack. But design taught me a lot about problem solving and structured thinking. I'm going to get it wrong, but so Charles and Ray Eames, a husband and wife couple that you two are familiar with.
Well, also, Eames is the middle name of our second child, Austin.
Oh, forgot about that.
That's how much we love Charles and
Ray
Eames.
We love them.
Yeah.
So Charles Eames, I think, had a definition of design, which I'm going to botch, unfortunately, but I think it was arranging elements to accomplish a particular purpose. So it's a very broad definition, but I think a lot of strong designers take broad definitions of design. And I think I learned a lot from my time there in that world. But I just was better as a PM because I'm not great at anything. I just am like reasonable at a large number of things.
That's how I feel too. That's why I'm doing this podcast, because I'm trying to learn a lot about all the things so I can be a good generalist.
Yeah, exactly. I'm absolutely a generalist. And so that fit
me
better.
We all have that in common.
Yeah. And so, no, I never would have expected it, but this sort of type of role, PM, and then eventually my role now, it just is a better fit. And I romanticize the opposite. I think, like, to be an amazing designer, an amazing machine learning engineer, or an amazing analyst, like, I think that's the coolest.
To be a specialist.
Yeah, but that's just, it's just not me.
But for all of you generalists out there, you too might one day be the head of Instagram. So, yeah.
Indeed.
It's the sky's the limit. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what design thinking is as someone who's a mediocre designer?
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, as the industry expert on mediocrity for design, I will now declare what design thinking is. I think design thinking means different things to different people. I have always thought about it as structured problem solving. And when you say it, it always seems super simple or even trite, but essentially being super clear about what your intention is, about what the different ways of accomplishing that intention might be, and then what the trade-offs are between those, and the process of evaluating those options and iterating through them is how I think about design thinking. So let's say we were going to, I don't know, design a table for where we're sitting right now. For those of you who can't see, we've got this like 4-foot diameter round table here. An interesting design problem would be like, what's the best table for this? right now, like, Dave's kind of shoved in the corner.
We've got the mics connected to other tables.
To be
tables.
Fair, Dave and Adam are both, like, 6'5 and 6'3. Mm-hmm. So shoved in the corner is largely because they have very long legs.
It's actually
but we
great.
Could design the table better.
Well, I think the table is great. But I think, like, if you could come up with a bunch of different ideas and you would try a couple, you would see what works. And the process of being generative, coming up with those ideas, thinking through the trade-offs, and then coming up with the best table you can come up with would be like a design process. So it would require design thinking.
So it's about the user experience at the end of the day.
Usually, yeah. Now, what user means different things in different contexts, right? So, but you might be, you know, if you're designing an ads interface, the user is the advertiser. But usually in the world of social media, when you talk about user, you're talking about the end consumer.
The user. And I actually think that's an interesting segue into my next point, because Facebook owns Instagram, is notorious for using data to define what users want. But you have this interesting historical past of design thinking and intuitively feeling and knowing what users want or asking them what they want. And so have there been times throughout your journey, and especially now as head of Instagram, where you've had to make some hard decisions where you're refuting the data and honoring what you think the users want instead, even if it doesn't show itself?
Definitely. When you work on something like social media, you're making lots of different decisions. And decisions, like anywhere else, require a whole bunch of different inputs. The data, which is usually like behavioral data, so like how much are people liking things or how much are people logging in, et cetera, is one input into that decision. But ultimately, there are other inputs too. There might be context about what's happening in the world right now. There might be some sort of intuition about what feels right. There might be competitive effects. There might be regulatory concerns or legal concerns. All these things are inputs. And then you make a decision once you figure out how to weigh those apples and oranges and giraffes sort of against each other. And that's sort of the trick. But yeah, we'd make decisions that are not good from a data perspective, but when we think they're the right thing to do, because we use judgment on a frequent basis. Sometimes there's some data on the other side. So for instance, we will remove inauthentic accounts, even though like our engagement numbers will go down because we don't want inauthentic engagement. So that's a judgment call. We do that all the time. Sometimes it's trickier where the value is very difficult to measure. And I think that's one of the key things is in a business or a world or maybe a context like ours, you have to be cognizant of your bias towards overvaluing the things that are easier to measure. Mm. If you're trying to make informed decisions, you're trying to measure the pros and cons. That's a good thing. But you're naturally going to more often value the things that you can measure compared to the things that you can't. And so, you know, ranking in my time in newsfeed was like the canonical example was what people do and how people feel. Right? Like you can measure that they like things. You can measure that they comment on things. You can measure that they share things. It's much more difficult to measure how they feel about the quality of their experience over the long run. And so you'll naturally bias towards the former at the expense of the latter. And you need to correct for that bias.
I think that people don't give you enough credit for this. I think that you as a leader in product and the internet and technology have perhaps more courage in this respect than almost anybody I really can't even, you know, name anybody else that's leading a product of the scale that you are that has had the guts to make those types of decisions. And in particular, I remember one we were talking about your decision to remove I can't remember what you called it, but the activity.
Oh, the following tab.
Yeah, the following tab in the notifications. You know, that was something that a lot of people loved. I'm sure by numbers, it was a small feature. It's not a default view, but I'm sure there were a lot of people that used it.
You should see my DMs.
And were very passionate about it. But, you know, it really did, I think, change behavior in that, you know, when you knew that feature existed as just an everyday user, I think you probably liked a few less things because you didn't want people to see you were liking this thing or that thing. And, you know, that probably changed those people's behavior and the way they feel about the product in such a way that, you know, taking that out was a hard decision. And I think you see this happen where a lot of people that run these other products, they don't make any changes because either the data says so or it's just been the same this way for so long, we're just not going to change it. And taking out a feature like that is a big deal. And I don't feel like there's any amount of data that could convince you to do it. So you really do have to run on feeling to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the kind words. That one was an interesting one. Sometimes the way to manage that sort of bias is to just do the hard work to figure out how to better measure the thing that is difficult to measure. Mm. And sometimes you just got to make a call based on your judgment.
Yeah.
And the former is easier at a big company once you've got that data, but it's sometimes impossible or sometimes not worth the effort because maybe it'll take years to measure things properly. For those of you who don't know, the following tab was, if you go to what we call the activity tab, what most people call notifications, so the little heart tab, you can see, you know, everyone who's liked your photos and that sort of thing. And we had a secondary tab there where you could see essentially what the people you followed were doing. So you could see, you know, what photos they liked recently. It's actually a pretty cool way to learn about new stuff. It just is a little creepy.
A little stalkery.
A little stalkery.
Yeah.
And when we unship that, we have a sort of a, I don't know what to call it, but like a...
I've never heard unship before.
Yeah, we call it unship. We have unship. Yeah. So
I like that.
I don't know what to call it. Is it like, is it a work stream? Is it a project? Is it an area? I don't know. It's a thing where we try and unship things. And
cool.
So we value a lot of things at Instagram, but the three primary values in how we approach our work are people first, simplicity, and craft. And to pursue those, to keep people in mind and to keep the app simple and to really hold a high bar for craft, one of the things that we try and do is unchip things. Because if you always just add forever, the inevitability is that the Instagram is going to become complicated and difficult to use and not be great at what it's for. So that was one of those.
Is likes another example of that?
Likes, you're making like counts private? Yeah, in spirit, I think is probably the concise answer to that. I'm excited about this. So for those of you who don't know, we're exploring removing public like counts. So essentially, as you scroll through feed, you can see photos, you can see that people liked something, you just can't see how many people liked it unless it was the thing that you posted, the photo or video that you posted. The idea being to depressurize the experience. Now, I want to be clear, though this is inspired by our research and our thinking around well-being and social comparison and particularly young people, it's not something that I think is going to move well-being in a measurable way. Well-being is, and mental health or medical, there's a lot of medical research and there are medical terms behind that. So I don't want to claim that this is like good for people's health. I think that's like going too far. But I do think that depressurizing the experience, particularly for young people, and given that Instagram is strong with young people, is a worthy enough cause to try and see if we can make this thing work. Now, there's a bunch of downsides here. It make it harder to see what's relevant on Instagram. And that's a big thing. That's a big part of what Instagram is about, is seeing what's trending, what's going on. It might make the experience less engaging or more difficult to use. It might cost us revenue. It might upset creators. These are all risks that we're currently working through. But we believe that it is interesting and compelling enough to try and work through those things.
Switching gears, Adam, you have two young boys.
I do.
And a third on the way.
A third boy.
Oh, much respect. We have two young boys pretty much the same age as yours, and we're tired a lot. But let's talk about social media with kids. I guess first off, what's your take on posting photos of them? I know that you actually do that often.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a conversation you had with Monica?
Yeah.
How did that go?
It went reasonable. Sort of a delicate subject. One of the things that I've had to start to think about in the last year or two that I didn't have to think about nearly as much before is just security or generally. That just comes along with the role. It's an amazing role. I'm so grateful for the opportunity, but it does come with a certain amount of complexity. And then when you have kids, that just makes those security concerns that much more important. And so with Nico and Blaze, I do share about them, but I try to be very careful about how I share about them. There's certain things I won't share. I certainly don't let people know where I am when I'm there. I pretty much only post them to stories because it's ephemeral. It sort of fades away. And I try to do so in moderation. I have other ways of sharing their lives, our family and our closest friends, and I can do that much more actively, and I do so. But on my main account, I try to be careful about security broadly and just generally not giving them too much exposure. As if and when my profile increases, that I might have to back off even further. And I think that's That's an ongoing conversation with my wife, and I want to always make sure that we're on the same page.
Do you think that's unique to you, or is this a thing that everyone has to think about?
I think that if you become a public figure, I think that there become new types of risks. And so there are more things to think about, but also the things that everyone has to think about, you just have to have a higher bar for or think about more. But in general, I think it's important for everyone to be thoughtful about how they share online and understand what's private and what's not, and understand the implications of what it would be to share that type of information. I still think it's important to be careful about what you share, who you share with, and how you share. I just think for me, there's a broader set of implications.
What do you think about making their own Instagram accounts for them? Like, and at what age will they take over or get to delete all the photos?
This is a very real question because our 5-year-old is like more sophisticated at computers than me now. And he's already got accounts on things. And I kind of can't believe it, but then I remember what I was like back then. So, you know,
well, he's definitely not allowed on, he's not allowed on Instagram. So don't tell me about it if he has an Instagram.
Well, your kids are technically on Instagram through an account you made them.
Yeah. So I've made accounts for both of my boys that I manage.
Even if it's a Finsta?
It's essentially, it's kind of like a Finsta. It's a second, it's not a fake Insta. It's like it's another account.
I always thought Finsta meant friend Insta.
Usually fake Insta. Well, so like if you're a teen, you usually have like, you usually have a main Instagram, which is like the one that everyone knows. And then you have a Finsta, which is like your close friends.
Yeah, but I thought the F stood for friends, not fake.
That depends who you talk to. In Japan, actually, often they have these micro Finstas. So the three of us might each have an account that's only following the three of us.
We're starting that.
Oh, like a family account would be a good purpose.
We're going to do this tomorrow.
Well, so this is actually three separate accounts that only follow each other. So you have your own little micro version of Instagram world. Shared accounts are another big thing with young people. So you know, the three of us could have one account that we share.
And we all post to.
Yeah, that happens a lot. And then more interest-based accounts is another one. So maybe I'm really into baking and I don't want people to know about it, but I have my baking account, my baking identity.
But the key is that most of these are private and your kids are private.
Yeah, so the kids are private. I manage them. It's a way for me to share their stories of their upbringing with our family and our friends. And we've got family and friends all over the world at this point. And it's actually one of the most meaningful parts about Instagram to me is these two private accounts that are actually quite small and small followings. Now, I'll have to give them the accounts at some point. And so, you know, you can't be on Instagram until you're 13. And I'm sure they'll immediately delete, or if I'm lucky, archive all of the content, and that'll be sad. But I do think that, you know, at some point you've got to trust your children, but you also have to help train them up. So a lot of different people do different things. Some of my friends with older kids let them use accounts on Instagram and Facebook, but insist on having access to them so that they can sort of audit the behavior.
I was going to ask, do you think it should be sooner? I saw over the holidays, or maybe it was Thanksgiving, that Facebook now has a Messenger for kids.
Messenger kids, yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, maybe Instagram should do that, because I think 13's pretty old in terms of how kids are interacting with technology. You know, they've got iPads, they want to play with things, and so you want to learn earlier. And so, you know, maybe that's something that should exist.
If there weren't a law, would you make the age younger to join Instagram?
To be clear, we can make a version of Instagram for people under 13. We just have to, it comes along with a bunch of regulatory obligations.
Right. Would you do Instagram kids then, I guess?
It's more like, do you think that
is that a valuable tool for kids under 13?
I think there is probably a version of Instagram that is limited in some way that would be really valuable for kids under 13. I think that if we were going to take that on, we want to make sure that we could, one, it could be sufficiently compelling two, it could be safe, and three, it would be compliant with with all the regulations, which, by the way, vary a lot from country to country. I'd actually love to take that on. For us, though, it's always about, you know, how many resources do we have, and what is the most effective way of creating more value for the people who use Instagram every day, and is it this or is it something else?
What do you think social media will be in 10 years? As our kids do become 13. And is it still going to be Instagram like we know it today? Will there be something new that they are using?
Is it impossible to call?
I think 10 years is real tough. I think the big question in 10 years is,
I mean, it goes back to when we were working at Facebook together. Like, how much has happened in the last 10 years? It's crazy.
It's unbelievable. the thing that we don't have the answer to that is sort of upstream from being able to answer your question more specifically is how much are we going to have a form factor or device like a phone? You know, if we have a 6-inch glowing rectangle that's connected to the internet, then I think a lot of things will be different. But fundamentally, if that is the centerpiece, our portal or our primary way into the digital world, then it'll be different, but it'll be different in the margins. If, whether it's wearables or something else, becomes ubiquitous and we get sort of untethered from this device, and maybe it's one other device or two other devices, or maybe it's just ambient everywhere, how we like make phone calls, text people, express ourselves online, then it's really hard to say, mm-hmm. given that we are, you know, we're about expression, we're about sharing your stories. What does that look like if the form factor is different, is super open? Obviously, we at Facebook are excited about VR and AR long-term, but it is just so early.
Right. Like yeah, 10 years might be when that's actually happening.
It makes me think of this question. I hadn't thought of this before we started, but what is Instagram? You know, to answer the question of what does it look like in 10 years, like, what is it? You know, I think there's a lot of different answers to that question.
Technically, I think the dry answer, but the most straightforward and honest answer is that it is, I think, a platform for communities. I think the primary thing we do, or the most important thing we do, is we connect people with those that they care about. For young people, it's unfortunately often not their family. It's, you know, close friends. For people like us, it's family too. But then on top of that foundation, we connect people with the things they love, but we specifically do so through the lens of the individual. What we do, I think, uniquely well is show you what it's like to be in someone else's shoes or give you a peek behind the curtain. We're not the best place to watch sports highlights. We might be the best place to keep up with athletes. We're not the best place to listen to music at all. We are maybe the best place to see what it's like to be a musician or to be in a musician's life. Mm. So that is our sweet spot. We are a tool that empowers individuals. Some are, you know, might just be average folk, and some of them might be wildly, hugely famous. But we empower individuals, regardless, up and down, with the ability to express themselves, and therefore connect with the others who are expressing themselves. And I think that's the heart of it. So, you know, if in 10 years, you know, everyone's wearing AR glasses, I don't know how Feed works or what our business model is necessarily, but I am pretty sure our focus will be on helping people tell their stories.
On that topic a little bit, as we're extrapolating what 10 years looks like, I'm actually curious how people around the world are using Instagram. What's the weirdest thing that's always been the most popular?
As a feature or like an actual
like an actual
thing?
Content, like
pimple popping videos,
the kitten,
really
pimple popping
people, like this is, it's subsided a little bit.
What's the most popular animal?
Oh, I don't know. I could guess.
What's your guess?
Cats or dogs?
Yeah, it's gonna be
kittens or puppies.
Worldwide, I think,
or
it's gotta
like
be
hedgehog.
I think it's gotta be cats worldwide.
You think?
Really?
Kittens? Yeah.
Kittens or
worldwide.
Cats?
I remember
cats always win the internet, right?
Cats. Mm. Cats tend to win. Onto Facebook side, like Korea is interesting. There's a lot of video consumption. Facebook does really well, by the way, in a lot of Asia right now.
Who's number one right now?
In what sense?
Like the biggest celebrity.
Oh, celebrity.
Is it The Rock?
No, it's no. Isn't it Selena or Taylor?
No, Ariana Grande.
Really?
Number one?
Is way up there. Selena Gomez is way up there. Ronaldo. Ronaldo is pushing 200.
Wow.
Is that the biggest?
I think it might be now.
Ronaldo.
Selena Gomez used to have it. Then I think it was Ariana Grande. I think it might now be Ronaldo.
Okay, Adam, do you have any new product features you want to tell us about?
We've been doing a lot on bullying.
Oh, that's cool.
So we launched Restrict. Did you guys see that?
Yes, and I think it's great.
So Restrict is it's more designed for teens, but it helps public figures too. But for those of you who don't know what it is, so if you talk to teenagers and you ask them, why don't you just block someone who's bullying you? You usually get two answers. One is fear of escalation. They're not only on Instagram, they got to see him at school.
Yep.
And they'll know that you blocked them and it's going to be, there's going to be some repercussions there. And two is that they're talking about you, and you need to be able to track what they're saying. And if you block them, they don't exist on Instagram for you anymore, and you can't see what they're saying, so you can't go around and do the damage control you need to do. So Restrict tries to give some power to the target of bullying by allowing them to approve someone's comments that they restrict on their stuff before it actually goes through, and allows them to read the messages that someone sends you without sending red receipts, but without letting the actor of bullying actually know. So you maintain plausible deniability.
Yeah, this is huge. And implementing this elegantly is very hard.
Mm. Yeah, it's been
Twitter
tricky.
Twitter needs to do this.
It's a tricky one. And I think we're going to add more features to it over time. And we want to be even careful about how much we talk about those features because we want to maintain people's ability to use it without fear of anyone knowing that they're using it.
It's hard.
And so that's the tricky thing. But it's been growing, which has been great to see. And it's been one piece of a sort of a broader focus on aggressive behavior or bullying online. And, you know, we would like to be leading on that issue. The other thing that we get a lot on this, and this is much more from the public figure side, is requests to do more to clean up comments.
Mm-hmm.
Comments don't seem to be...
Can you turn them off?
You can turn them off on a per post basis, but people are hesitant to do that. But I think there's a lot that we can do in that space, but it's just not nearly as problematic from a 14-year-old perspective as it is from a public figure perspective. Who was it? Was it Cardi B? I think it was Cardi B had this amazing post about making like counts private. And she has this
Her point of view?
She has a 3-minute video on Instagram. You should check it out. And you can't see her face. You can only see the top of her hair because she said she didn't like how she looked. I think she said she looked like a chopped sandwich. And then she just goes on this thing about, she's amazing. I love her.
Unbelievably
and
good.
And she's like, oh, they're taking away the likes, but what they really should do is clean up the comments. And it's like, she just goes on this thing for 3 minutes about it. And I think she's... Right, for people like her, that's the more meaningful thing to do. But for teenagers...
What does that mean to clean up comments?
I think we don't know yet. If you are a public figure, you get a lot of comments. There's spam, people just trying to, there's a lot of first, that kind of thing. But there can be harassment and there can be aggressive sort of interactions. And so we could help you sort them, we could help you moderate them, we could help you clean them up. We do nudges right now. So if you comment something that seems to be aggressive, we say, are you sure you want to comment that?
Interesting.
And that's people, they slam that one all the time because they're like, look, if someone's going to be a jerk, they're just going to be a jerk. And the truth is, most of the time, there's no one silver bullet for any of these problems, but we hope that these types of things add up. And
this is definitely under talked about, People frequently, when they're begging social media platforms for new features, they don't take into account these types of ideas where if you just put a simple little tax in, right? Or even you just say literally, hey, are you sure you want to say that?
Yeah.
It actually is quite effective. And people just I guess most people don't see it.
Yeah.
So it's hard for them to know what it feels like to get one of those. But it often is really
debate about whether Facebook and Instagram should interfere with free speech or not, right?
Yeah. Well, what I like about the nudge, and we do this for both comments and now for posts, is that we don't prevent you from saying what you want to say. We just create an extra step and make sure you feel good about it and make it easy to undo if you don't. And most people probably just keep saying what they would say anyway, but if a reasonable minority change, then it is absolutely worth the cost it took us to do that.
I've never gotten the nudge, so I feel good about my
comments. Maybe you should just...
What do you think of all these people that make these types of things usually have a business of some kind?
Mm-hmm.
Are there types of businesses that you want people to be in? It strikes me that some of these folks they built a big photography thing or, things that are in conflict with the larger Facebook and Instagram advertising ecosystem, they may not have a business long term. And so what type of businesses do you want to support? How do you want people making money? Because I hear this actually question more lately.
Yeah.
I don't know why. But
there are a couple different things to say there. So if you look at the business side, the group that we care most about is a group that we call creators. So public figures, influencers, these all overlap, but essentially the individuals behind the crafts. And we just think that's important because that's what people care about. That's what people
now are we
want.
Talking about people like that we just said, like Ariana Grande and The Rock, that are big celebrities, they've got movies and things they're doing over here, and then they come to Instagram? Or are you talking about people that built up themselves on Instagram?
Both. I think, honestly, I'm most excited about the tail. I'm most excited about those small creators, like the illustrator in Italy who draws on top his photography and makes some cool, tells cool stories, all the way up to The Rock. The reason why I'm excited about niche and smaller creators is because the whole promise of the internet and the promise of giving everyone the ability to express themselves and giving everyone a platform is that we should all be able to learn about and connect to things that we love that we didn't even know existed. We don't have to listen to the same 40 songs. I mean, you might learn that you're in Afropunk, and you might learn you're into like minimal tech house, and like that's cool, and you wouldn't know that.
I don't even know what that is, so exactly. I might be into minimal tech house. To find that today.
You actually have friends who are.
She needs to hang out on the mission.
If
more.
I had yeah. a stalker feature function where I could see the things you like.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's so interesting about the internet broadly and about these platforms like Instagram broadly. So whether it's news or entertainment or film or music, I'm really passionate about the niche. But we care about creators broadly. And then it's also because that's where the world is moving to. People are more interested in the athlete than the team than they ever were before. They're more interested in actors relative to shows than ever before. You're seeing Netflix stars blow up before the show's even released. They announce it, and then like some actor who had 10,000 followers on Instagram will go to a million or two in a couple days before the show even gets dropped.
This was just my whole thesis of why I called it Brit & Co., not because I wanted to be the center of this thing. And I had to explain this to a bunch of venture capitalists for many years, but because people want to associate themselves with people.
Yeah, and they want authentic stories and they want to connect. And so we're focused on creators, and there's a bunch of different business models to help support creators. But we also focus a lot on businesses.
Dave, do you have any final questions for Adam? Because I just have one.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering, what's the hardest experience been for you being the head of Instagram?
I mean, there's different types of hard experiences. One type is, you know, when you get really deep into the integrity and safety issues and you get out there on the road and you hear difficult stories and you get slammed and that kind of thing. That isn't as hard as it probably should be for me, just because for some good reasons and bad reasons. The good reasons are, you know, usually you care deeply about the issue too, and you've got that aligned. And so it's okay to get slapped around a little bit if you feel like, you know, the person, either you agree with the person or at least you know that the person is doing it for a good cause. And then the other reason is just I've become a bit desensitized after being, you know, representing newsfeed publicly to publishers for so long. It's pretty...
Well, and you've been one of the only ones willing to go and engage in those conversations, particularly on Twitter.
A lot of times.
Fed to the wolves, Adam. Yeah.
My Twitter is a really dark place. I say this a lot, but it's because I follow all of our biggest critics.
Check every DM you get.
No, I closed them. It was too much.
But I admire it, frankly. You know, I've always had a much more difficult time engaging with the critics. You know, it's difficult.
Yeah, it's emotionally taxing. I think what I actually find more difficult, though, is if I feel like I failed in some significant way, either like something happened that we could have foreseen and prevented, like, you know, some integrity problem popped up and we should have caught it ahead of time, et cetera. Or if I failed my people. I mean, if you run a large organization, people always think that you have all of this power and you make all these decisions. And that's kind of true. But the truth is, it's all through other people. Mm-hmm. You're only as good as your people. You need great people and you need them to be motivated. And I try to instill a sense of family in the organizations that I lead. That's a little bit ambitious, but I want there to be room for dissent. I want there to be trust. I want there to be hard conversations, but from a place of support and kindness. And when I fail my people, just me personally, that's tough.
I appreciate that. I think we all do, having been still our founders, CEOs, running organizations. My final question for you, Adam, is, okay, you've spent 12 years now almost at Facebook and Instagram. Mm-hmm. What have those 12 years taught you about what it is to be human?
I think a few different things come to mind. One, it's like people are complicated. To be human is to be complicated. You can have conflicting beliefs, conflicting emotions, and they're both true, even though they're at odds. Like I think a lot about from my ranking days, you know, people's short-term and their long-term interests, their first order and their second order preferences. Like you want to get fit and go to the gym a lot, but you don't want to go to the gym when I call you at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. Like, mm-hmm. those things are both true, though they're at odds. So we are complicated. We also are mostly, this is ironic to say after the first one, rational within our own local incentive structure. So most people will act rationally within the incentives of the system in which they're around. And so they will, you know, if it's, they'll do what's easier if it's in terms of sharing, but they'll also do what's easier. You know, bad actors will also do what's easier. So for instance, if, I don't know, like a, you know, if it is, if you can post junk on the internet and you can pay $19 to create it and you get $20 worth of ads, like value from like some low quality ad network, not Facebook, you're going to do that because it's printing money all day long. And then if we can make it cost you $21, then you'll just stop doing it and you'll do something else bad. So we're like, incentives are so, so important in managing an organization and managing an individual and managing a platform. And that we're really interesting, emotional creatures. There's a richness to what we do and to how we interact. And that is like ironic maybe to say this too, but in a world where we like running a platform where we're constantly looking at data and what people are doing and how they're using the platform, it is so clear to me after doing this for over 10 years that there's just so much nuance that is impossible to fully grasp. And I think it's important to embrace that reality, because otherwise you run the risk of sort of being overly confident in what you know and what you don't. And that I think is just really problematic. Like, what's it, like false precision maybe? It's like, you know, you think you understand what's going on. Like, I think I kind of know why stories work and people don't comment and like in Japan, but I don't know what that's like. I'm not Japanese. I've only been to Japan a few times. Like, and so I think that humility, particularly in the face of how complicated we are as humans, is super important if you're going to try to build something that a lot of people use.
Mm-hmm. And probably never satisfy 100%.
Oh, not even close.
Thank you so much for your time today. And where can we find you, Adam?
At Mosseri on Instagram or Twitter.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Teach Me Something New, a production of iHeartRadio and Brit & Co. I'm your host, Brit Morin. Send us your feedback and find more information about each episode at brit.co/listen. You can also find me on social media, at Brit and at Brit & Co. A special shout out to my two co-hosts, Ange, who you can find on Instagram, at Angelica Temple, and of course, my husband and partner in everything, Dave Morin. Teach Me Something New is executive produced by Christine Swor and Ali Perry, with additional production and sound design by Aaron Kaufman. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. See you next time.